It's the Dearly Departed Podcast, featuring your host, historian Scott Michaels, and filmmaker Mike Dorsey.
All right, it's episode 25, I think, here of the Dearly Departed Podcast. And this is our 2020 holiday special, so to speak.
The extravaganza.
And I'm Mike Dorsey.
Scott Michaels.
And this is Dearly Departed Podcast. So we are going to do a, since it's the holiday special, we are going to do the Christmas at Pee-wee's Playhouse television special from 1988. And it's kooky cast of walk-on characters. And it is a wild one. And it came, it was recommended by one of our Patreon supporters, Melissa. So thank you, Melissa, for suggesting this one. And if you are not a Patreon supporter, hustle on over there and sign up if you don't mind. It's $2 a month, and you can do five, and you get early access to our shows every month, like this one, if you do five a month. And everybody that subscribes on Patreon also gets we do extra mini shows between our main ones, and we just recorded our mini show for December. So. Thanks to all of our Patreon supporters for helping keep the show going.
Yeah, the one that we do usually for the Patreons is the obituaries since the last episode. So we touch on the biggies that died, and so that is the exclusive to the supporters on Patreon. So please sign up and thank you.
Yeah, we just talked about Alex Trebek and David Prowse and Dame Barbara Windsor. And Rafer Johnson and Bobby Brown Jr. and a bunch of other cool, interesting people that passed away since we did our last show. So what have you been up to, Scott? Your background's interesting.
It's the same background I've ever had, but I'm not here. I will. In fact, I can go anywhere. I can go to Pee-wee's Dinosaurs. Now I know, right? Now, we've moved, and luckily I grabbed a screen capture of my old office, which is familiar, because where I am right now is basically a room with nothing on the walls, and we've moved just near Palm Springs, and we've been here a little over a month now, full time. And it's a different life, and I like it out here. It's nice and quiet, and it gets me away from the stress. Since Dearly Departed Tours is pretty much non-existent anymore, I just figure why should I stay there when I can go someplace? It's a bit more chill. So right. Get a bit of elbow room, and I can see the mountains in my backyard. And it's like I say, it's a gentler life. I'm not sure if how I'm going to adjust to it in the long run, because I've always lived in major cities. You know, I've been in Los Angeles, right on the main street, in Detroit, in Chicago, and London, and always right in the center of things. And now if I'm going to see a show at the Hollywood Bowl, it's a two-hour trip. So I'm not sure, you know, in the long run how this is all going to go. But we made this choice, Troy and I did, and I'm happy with where we are.
I love Palm Springs, and I lived in Temecula for a time after I had lived in L.A. for a few years, and it was actually kind of nice. I'd come out once a month, maybe. I'd come out for a weekend, and I'd stay in a different hotel every time almost in L.A., and it's kind of a chance to, like, try out all the different spots I never had an excuse to because I lived here. So it can kind of be fun, to be perfectly honest. It's almost like you come in and you get the best parts of the city, and then you go back out to where it's a little quieter for a while. So, yeah. I love Palm Springs, so that's really cool.
I'm not looking forward to 120 degrees every summer. That's the part that I'm like.
We'll see if you like it in August.
yeah.
If any of you follow my social media, I did something that Scott and I said we would never do again. I went all the way out to Barker Ranch in Death Valley. A few weeks ago, which is where the Manson family was arrested for the last time before being charged with the Tate LaBianca murders. And it was wild because, you know, when we were last out there, the house was still standing, and now it's just ruins. The roof is gone and a lot of the walls are gone, and because it burned down a couple years after we were out there. It burned down in 2009. But it was kind of cathartic, I guess, to go out there again and see it with fresh eyes, you know, not just my memories and from when we filmed the Six Degrees of Helter Skelter. To see it again was interesting. It was for a show I'm working on for Motor Trend TV, which is one of the Discovery channels. It used to be Velocity. That's their car channel. So we're doing a car-centric crime series. So I pitched them on doing something Manson-related with the trucks out there, the Power Wagons, the Dodge Power Wagons that have been abandoned out there. It was actually a really interesting trip for a couple of reasons. The one that has the Helter Skelter spray painted on the back has been dug out of the dirt and is just sitting there on top of the ground now, the one that was behind the ranch. And it has been super pit clean, even more than before. The doors are gone. Like nothing. It's really, really picked over. But it was half buried in the dirt when we were there, and now they've kind of made that into more of a proper road. So somebody dug it out and kind of pushed it off to the side of the road. So you can kind of see more of it now than you could before. And then I had a fascinating conversation with a guy that manages the store in Ballarat. And it was
they just redid it, didn't they?
Yeah, it's nice.
Yeah.
It's nice, and the guy, or nicer, and the guy, it's not the guys that we dealt with when we were out there. It was a younger guy, and he claims to be the grandson of the Barkers.
Hmm.
And he had all kinds of stories. We sat out there and talked for a half hour, probably at least, and he, you know, he told the story about the power wagon that's parked there at Ballarat, which he says is the one that Tex attempted to flee in. And it got stuck in the lake bed, and he said that his grandmother then claimed the car because the police just left it out there stuck in the mud. He says they kind of processed it for evidence and then just left it. They had no use for it, and she was kind of like, "Well, he doesn't need it anymore," so she took it. And he claims she drove it around for a few years, all over the place until it started having, you know, mechanical issues and stuff, and that's when they just parked it there in front of the shop and left it.
Interesting.
So that's his claim about the about what happened with that, and what was the other thing he said? He talked about, you know, them getting rid of the bus, which we've heard that story before, the Manson bus that was left behind. He also said something interesting. I don't know if I'd ever read this before, but he said, you know, when they were raided, of course, the law enforcement didn't know yet about their connection to the Tate LaBianca murders. You know, they were arrested for vandalism. And it wasn't until later. So he said there was the initial raid on the camp when they arrested everybody, and then they came back, you know, however many weeks later, once they had been tied to the crimes, the police came out a second time and did a real, like, processed the ranch, as the Barker Ranch, as a crime scene, looking for evidence, basically, that might help with the murder. So it was, the police went out there a couple of different times.
I see.
Once they found out what they needed, you know, they needed to, that these people were involved in murders. So
right.
I mean, I don't know if they found anything, but yeah, it makes perfect sense that they would go out there and see if there was any evidence left behind. So, you know, there could have been murder weapons out there and stuff that they didn't even know to look for when they raided.
Well, I mean, they went out there at least two times afterwards for body digs and didn't come up with anything. So,
right.
So yeah, interesting.
So, yeah, it was great. And I forget, this is also funny. You know, when we went out there, we had like a little Garmin GPS with us.
Yes.
You remember? And it took us right there. Yeah. I mean, it was accurate. I did not anticipate that, you know, that's satellite connected. And there is no cell phone coverage at all anywhere in Panamint Valley, around Ballarat at all. As soon as you drop down into that valley, your cell phone goes to no bars and you never get it back until you leave the valley. So I didn't realize.
Yeah, it was like Trona is the cutoff point. Yeah.
That's basically it. Yeah, once you leave Trona, you have no cell phone coverage. And so I didn't anticipate, that means your map is going to go away. So it was there was a moment there when I'm like, it was 13 years ago that we were out there, and trying to remember all these different dirt roads 13 years later, somehow I was able to find it. But it was, I didn't think I was going to be able to do it there for a time. So that's something to keep in mind if you ever go out there. Either have a good, you know, a printout of a map with you so you can keep track of things. And also if you have a Garmin or something like that that's satellite connected, you'll have better luck getting in there. But also, you know, the locals, I think, or various people have taken down a lot of the markers. So remember when it said Golar Wash? On like that metal can, that's gone. The various little street signs that are in the canyons are gone. So you really, unless you know where you're going, it's tough to figure out.
Was it just you in a car?
It was two cars. It was three crew in two different vehicles. I was in a pickup truck.
Okay.
It was a two-wheel drive truck. I did fine. I mean, it's a bit of a rough road, but if you have some experience off-roading, you can get in with two wheels as long as you have good clearance. And then the other car with us was a four-wheel drive truck. So, yeah. But it's cool to go out there and see it. And you don't see anybody out there. I mean, we were at the ranch for probably 3 or 4 hours. Never saw anybody. We only saw people when we were going in and out of the canyon. So, and it's just a really wild and exotic place to go spend a day.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Yeah. And then the other thing I wanted to mention was I started watching Scrubs for the first time. The sitcom, the Zach Braff sitcom from like a decade ago. And it was technically, I mean, it started, I mean, it premiered, I think like 3 weeks after 9/11 happened, was that show's premiere. But there's a really disturbing thing in it that most people watching would probably not pick up on, but I definitely did. At the end of episode 7 in season 2, episode called My First Step, Zach Braff and Sarah Chalk's characters jump off, bungee cord jumping, suicide bridge.
Oh, interesting.
Huh. Yep. And it is right over the canal, you know, that concrete canal that it looks down on? That's where they go off. It's right there. And the actors were supposed to do it themselves, but chickened out kind of at the last second, and they got two stunt people to do it for them. And according to Sarah Chalk, years later on Twitter, she claimed that those two stunt people, man and woman, met for the first time on that set, fell in love, and were married, and are now married husband and wife from doing that bungee cord jump together. But it's really weird to see somebody, I mean, even though they're stunt doubles, to see two famous people, quote unquote, jump off the suicide bridge, and the camera like goes over the side with them, and then there's like the view looking up at them jumping off. I mean, it's what it would look like to see someone actually jumping off that bridge, which is one of the more heavily used suicide jumping spots in all of Los Angeles there near Pasadena. So.
Yeah, I haven't been up there in a while, but the last time I was there, they had sort of makeshift fences up there, but they probably made something a bit more permanent now. So you, you know, people will find a way. It doesn't matter. But Suicide Bridge is this Colorado Street Bridge in Pasadena that's massively huge. When you're going over, it doesn't seem that way. You look over the edge, and it's like, holy Christ, it's really, it is a tall bridge. So, and yeah, a landmark as the Suicide Bridge. I think they call it the Arroyo Seco Bridge. I think that's what it's really called.
Yeah, it's just south of the Rose Bowl. It's a beautiful old bridge, and it's used a lot for filming and stuff because it's a gorgeous old bridge. That was my news.
Cool.
And you moved to Palm Springs.
I did. Yeah, I'm trying to think of anything really good that I've done. I mean, I've done some stuff. I've been working on the YouTube stuff, and the last thing I did was. I got a lottery ticket. I'll show you. I just got a new one, but it's called California Dreamin'. And I live 5 minutes drive from John Phillips' grave, who wrote the song California Dreamin' of the Mamas and the Papas. So the last video I did, I went with my lottery ticket and I scratched it off at his grave. And I won $10, and this is my replacement. So I've got to go back to his grave now and do this one. but I'm literally down the road from Sinatra and Sonny Bono and a whole ton of people. It's an odd place, Palm Springs. I like it a lot, but it's an odd place. It's got a real showbiz vibe, which is why we chose it, because we can, you know, maybe do a tour or we can open up our museum here. Absolutely. And I've already had a couple of people reach out. One guy that used to be Liberace's protege and another gentleman who's involved with local politics, and they've reached out to welcome me. So we'll see what happens. But I'm excited to see. Yeah, I'm excited to see what's going to happen once tourism kicks back in again. It's not, you know, we're not LA County, so things are a little bit different here as far as, you know, the lockdowns and the closures go. I could say it's just a bigger space. There's lots, there's lots of room here, which is why.
Right.
It's not as intense as LA is, so they're not as diligent with closures and things.
Right. Yeah, there's some amazing old neighborhoods. Of course, you got Twin Palms, you know, one of Sinatra's homes is out there. The Elvis honeymoon house is out there, which I think recently sold or was recently put up for sale. The Kaufman Desert House, one of the most famous houses in the world is there. The Elrod House, another famous one from one of the James Bond films, the second film. Yeah, I love it out there. And Modernism Week is a lot of fun and draws a lot of tourism business there, and the whole town kind of gets behind it. So, yeah.
Yeah. It's great. It's an interesting place. It's a tourist town. You know, there's not a whole lot of industry here, you know, retail mostly, if there's going to be one. So it's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a good place to shop for mid-century modern furniture, although you're not necessarily going to find any good deals, but you find cool stuff.
I mean, the thrift stores here, there's one in there because people come here to die. You know what I mean? People are just, they do. Right. Old people, they just die. And the thrift stores are spectacular. You know, you could find some really cool stuff, and we have. So, yeah,
there's cool vintage clothing stores there and stuff. Yeah. It's cool.
The cool kind, not like the, you know, right. 40s stuff, but it's all like the Lovey Howell, you know? So,
yes. No, absolutely. Yeah, the big flowery printed muumuus and stuff. Yeah.
Yes. I love it.
The cocktail dresses from the 60s and 50s. Yeah, it's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
So, did we get any hate mail?
Hate mail.
Well, you know, we got some love mail and we got some hate mail. Now,
all right.
So I did a movie called on my YouTube channel, The Death of Donald Turnipseed, The Man Who Killed James Dean, accidentally.
Yeah.
And people are, you know, no, Jimmy was going too fast. Well, maybe Jimmy was going fast, but it doesn't matter. The guy made an illegal left in front of James Dean, so he didn't gauge
it
right.
It's the fault of him. It's the fault of the guy that turned in front of the other guy, yeah.
Right. So they ruled it, you know, that it was accidental, and it was nobody's intentional fault. It wasn't really malicious. It wasn't, he just never saw him. It was accidental. He was an accidental killer, and that is legitimately a thing. Look it up. I've learned a lot about it since I've been doing the stuff with the crisis response team. So it's a legitimate thing. So I get a lot of like, he was not a killer, it was Jimmy's fault, et cetera, et cetera. It's like, okay, whatever. That's your interpretation, but it wasn't Jimmy's fault, even if he was speeding. But right. I call him Jimmy. Everyone calls him Jimmy who loves James Dean. You know, it's always, you know, it's Jimmy. But this guy says, Jimmy, were you and James Dean buddies? You were so close that you were so comfortable to use a nickname that nobody else ever called him? Or are you just trying to come off as some pretentious jackwagon who is only cool in his own mind? I'm going for the jackwagon because I never heard that one before. I love that.
You're a jackwagon.
Yeah. Now, the other thing that was a comment that I got was about, I did a video about Stephen Parent, who was the kid who was the kid who didn't belong at the house on Cielo Drive the night of the Tate murders. He was killed in the driveway. Now, I put a theory out there, which I still stand by, that he was actually killed last, not first. Okay.
Interesting.
And there's several different reasons why I believe that to be true. And I put them forward in this video, you know. And I'm not saying it's definitive. I'm just saying that this is something that I think is worthy of looking at. It's a different theory. And people get really pissed off because the eyewitness accounts say otherwise. And I'm like, the eyewitnesses were freaking murderers and liars. So,
and
you know, who says
drugs.
And there were a couple of
LSD.
A couple of them, they were jacked up on speed. And like, they weren't thinking straight anyway. But that was a theory that I put out there, and I think it's I gave the reason I feel that way. So this is like one of the most pretentious emails I've ever got. And this is the theory, quote unquote, that Parent was killed last, has the odor of DIY, sleuth for a day, crank revisionism, multi-eyewitness testimony from those with nothing to gain, flatly contradicts this theory. That should be good enough, and it is. Though not to pile it on. We also have the damage to the fence railing more plausibly explained by Tex and the girls pushing the car back up the driveway after Parent was killed first. Now, there's damage to a fence on the property, damage to Stephen Parent's car. I put forward what I thought happened in this video, and he's going by what was written in Helter Skelter, which, you know, we've all learned that is a little bit different than what really happened. So, Stephen Parent said, I won't tell anyone, easily interpreted as not telling anyone about seeing Tex hopping the fence and brandishing weapons, obviously up to no good, not about seeing seven people killed. Well, see, my theory was Stephen Parent, if he was the first victim, why did he say to Tex Watson, don't worry, I won't say anything? He didn't see anything. Right. All he was doing was pulling up to the gate. He didn't know who it was hopping over the fence. So my theory was he already saw what went on. He was taking off, went up to the gate, accidentally put the car into reverse and hit the fence, then put it forward. And Tech stopped him. And then he said,
"Get out of there,
I won't say anything. That makes more sense." So he's saying, well, the murderer's there. They say differently. And I'm like, all right. So to me, that's how I interpret it. Tex hopped over the fence. Another thing that's important to note is that Stephen Perrin had knife wounds on his arm. Then he was shot, which would have meant Tex, if the whole thing took place right in front of the gate, Tex would have had to slice him with one hand and shoot him with the other. Nobody's that ambidextrous, especially in a situation like that. So it makes more sense to me that back there, Stephen Perrin was hurt with a knife, then up at the gate was shot. That's the way I interpret it, and that's what I subscribe to personally. I'm not saying you have to, but that's just what I put forward. So he said, Tex Watson, not the brightest bulb in the chandelier, fired shots before entering the Tate house. So, finally, to assume that Tex would need ambidexterity, which you further assume he lacked, to stab and shoot, wallows in rank speculation. That a theory, in quotes again, this bad can be submitted, presumably in good faith, to counter the, quote, official version, is testament to how solid that version really is, which is bullshit. But it was like the most pretentious, I didn't even want to say the word, but it's
that guy sounds like a real jack wagon.
Oh my God. Yeah. Right. And usually people usually say nice things. If they say nasty things, I'm fine with that too. But this is such a pretentious thing, you know.
Right.
Crank revisionism. Anyway. So those are the two Haiti ones. Now, I got a couple ones.
If you ever write an autobiography, that's what you should name it.
Crank revisionism.
Crank revisionism.
Well, there was somebody that when I got sued by Selena's father because I put together that horrible it wasn't horrible, I put it together for Find a Death, the story of her death, and somebody posted it, and somebody, one of the comments was, "I have desire of vomit." And, that was going to be my autobiography. I have desire of vomit. But, you know, there are these nuggets of really interesting information that come out. And this is a woman who wrote to me. I live in Fairmount, Indiana, James Dean's hometown, where he's buried, where he's from and where he's buried. I can see his grave standing at my kitchen window. His family are really nice. Until this year, we had James Dean Days and the last weekend of September. It's always a huge thing in Fairmount for that weekend. They have a lookalike contest, old cars, et cetera.
There's a museum there. It has a bunch of his stuff.
Yes, there's a couple of them. So he says that not widely known, but he was bisexual and had a fetish of public pee. Okay, whatever. His tombstone has hundreds of lips, kisses on it, cigarettes, and signatures of visitors. It also gets stolen about once every 10 years. Over the aisle, this is the interesting bit. Over the aisle is the grave of Mary O'Connor. She was Hugh Hefner's secretary for decades. When she died, unbeknownst to the locals, Hugh rolled into town for her funeral and got his photo standing next to James Dean's grave. It also said to be haunted. There's some weird facts for you. But I looked it up, and Mary O'Connor is indeed buried in Fairmount Cemetery, in the same cemetery as James Dean. And I met her I did an episode of The Girls Next Door. I met her at the Playboy Mansion. And it was just, okay, there's some weird Hugh Hefner in Fairmount. Because a lot of celebrities do visit Fairmount for James Dean, to pay homage or whatever. But the fact that the Playboy secretary, who, you know, is from Fairmount, is there in Fairmount by James Dean, I think it's a fascinating little nugget of information.
And Hugh Hefner is buried next to Marilyn Monroe, another icon who died too young.
Yes. But Hugh didn't die too young.
No. Marilyn Monroe.
No, but he bought that grave. God, he paid $15,000 for that grave back in the 70s. And that thing is worth, if he would have sold it, would have easily more in the mill, easily. But she was the first centerfold for Playboy, and she was on the first cover of Playboy magazine. And I'm not sure if the pictures inside were the red calendar pictures, but certainly helped put Hugh Hefner on the map. Yeah. Now, the other one, this is an interesting one. A woman named Ivy sends this. I live in the mountains of North Carolina and grew up 20 minutes from the Land of Oz amusement park in Beach Mountain, North Carolina. This is obviously about our Wizard of Oz podcast.
Sure.
It isn't abandoned, no matter what the internet says. It opened in June of 1970, and Debbie Reynolds and Carrie Fisher were both at the ribbon-cutting ceremony. At the time, the park was a big deal. Unfortunately, several things happened. Several of the shops caught fire. An original Dorothy dress purchased from the MGM auction and other, not sure what, collectibles were stolen, and other things that caused the park to be shut down. I think sometime in the late 90s, it was reopened for one weekend a year in October, and it's a frigid on top of a mountain place. The last few years, they were open several weekends in the summer. Thank you for all your hard work in keeping this history alive. I really appreciate all you've done and continue to do. A very kind email from Ivy. And Jennifer, thank you for the other email about James Dean. And that's that for the hate mail. Although I have one more piece of mail that came in. This is a guy by the name of Jed Keck, who is a longtime listener of the podcast. I think we may have even mentioned him before. But he says, you've mentioned Tom Lester and Robert Blake in your podcast. Now, Tom Lester played Evan Greenacres, and Robert Blake is obviously Robert Blake. So he said, I just remembered, back in 1982, I went to church to hear Tom Lester speak. He's a very religious man. And remember him saying that he and Robert Blake were friends. They worked out at the gym together. He said Robert's nickname for him was Naz, or the Naz, short for Nazarene, of course. Hmm. So I just thought that was a nice, interesting nugget of information from Jed Keck. So thank you. And thank you for the people that write in. Even if you write dicky things, we read them and we enjoy them. So thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you for your time.
Yes. It's time for the main feature.
So we are talking about the Christmas at Pee Wee's Playhouse, the Christmas special from 1988 that almost has its own little cult following, in addition to the main show itself. So Scott, you're the big fan of this. So
yeah, I've said it since it came out. It is the greatest hour of television ever made. I mean, the day it came out, I lost my mind over it because it was so incredible. It was pure, you know, because it was, you know, the Pee Wee character was just this kid in awe, you know, that was the character. And but then the guest stars came out. It's like, oh my, every 2 seconds. I mean, these legendary people come out for 15-second cameos. Right. And it is jam-packed with stuff. I mean, and now I just got the Blu-ray, because I must have seen that show, you know, I'm not going to say hundreds of times, but probably, you know, certainly dozens of times. And the Blu-ray comes out, and it's like, oh, my God, I see all the stuff going on in the background, and things are spinning and whirring, and it's the costumes are spectacular, and it was just legend after legend. It was a great show. Starting with the day that it premiered, it aired on the day of the Lockerbie bombing.
Really?
Yeah, December 21st, 1988, 259 people were killed in a bomb blast over Lockerbie, Scotland on a Pan Am flight. And that was the day Pee-wee's Christmas special aired. It was shot at Hollywood Center Studios, and where they made the Addams Family and the Beverly Hillbillies and I Love Lucy for the first 2 years of it. And they threw it together. I mean, this thing was done in like a week, in November, and it aired in December. I mean, they were talking about shooting this on Thanksgiving, and they just sent these letters out to everybody they thought would be fun to be in the show. And they were shocked at the responses, of people that said that they would do it. And people would literally stop in for 20 minutes and do their cameo and leave. The only one that they asked, as far as I understand it, was Elizabeth Taylor, who didn't show up, and she sent a regret. But all these, it's mind-numbing how many people are in this.
When you see the list, you before you watch the show, you're like, how in the world did they fit all these people into a one-hour special? But that's why. Yeah. They just rolled them through.
Yeah. And then there were other ones like, Joan Rivers and Oprah and Whoopi Goldberg, who just showed up in TV segments, you know, right. Video calls. So they didn't have to be there. So it was like, right. It's really clever, you know, and it's a very clever show because they, like, for instance, Magic Johnson, you know, he shows up in it, and he had a game that day. He had 1 hour to do, and he showed up. And it was clever because there's a character on Pee-wee's Playhouse called the Magic Screen. And the Magic Screen, you go through it, and it would show you film clips, a lot of, you know, stock cartoon footage, et cetera, and educational films. And they, you know, the Magic Screen and Magic Johnson, they said were cousins. It's like, that's really clever. I was really surprised by that. And the Countess, who was the, you know, the regal cow, who everything she says has a moo in it, and you know, got Princess Zsa Zsa there, you know, and it's like, oh my god, that's really clever. How did they they came up with this stuff really quickly? Yeah. And that just goes to show you, though, how, you know, certain things are organic, and they can try to do a show like that, and it could not be. It would be so contrived and not as on the cuff as this one. They put it together in a couple of weeks, threw this together, and here we are, you know, 30 years later, still talking about it.
Yeah. All right. Well, do you want to dive into the names?
Okay. Well, so it started with the chorus, the UCLA men's chorus, who dressed up to be Marines, the Marine Corps, but it was actually the UCLA men's choir who all had to shave their heads to do it, and to make it look like they were military. And and they came up with this whole song the song was actually written by John Paragon, who was one of the founders of the Groundlings comedy troupe, who, you know, we know Terry Bolo, who's the works at Dearly Departed Tours. She's one of the founders. Lorraine Newman, Elvira, Cassandra Peterson, Phil Hartman, they were all founders of the Groundlings, as was John Paragon, who plays Jombi, and Paul Rubens, who was Pee-wee Herman. So the two of them wrote this, and they wrote that that song, which in the commentary tracks is fascinating because everyone loves that the most in the show. The people that worked on it were like, the opening sequence is Paul Rubens' favorite sequence because he comes out, the chorus is singing, all of a sudden it goes wacky, and the two background singers come in and they just introduce pow, 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 50 names of all, I think I counted, it was 52 names that they, you know, and my special guest star and the regulars, Missy Vaughn, Terry, and then our special guest stars. It was like pow, pow, pow. It was really clever. And the two, when it first opened, you know, it's like right out of Rankin Bass, you know, those old classic Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and Santa Claus is Coming to Town, those old stop animation, they call that. And so the beginning of the show is right out of that, with the moving snowmen and the little elves, the mechanical elves. It goes into the Marines, then the background singers come in, and they do, and the Supremes, they were like the Supremes. There were two girls that came in wearing gold shimmery dresses, and they're doing the, you know, Pee-wee's Christmas thing and the choreography. And Nikki Harris was one of them, and she was she worked with Madonna for years and years as a singer, a background singer, and a proper, you know, cuts albums on her own sort of thing. But it was another one of those odd kind of, because it's not even in the IMDb. It's not, you know, the cast is listed, and they have like one or two of the Marines who were in it for, you know, a couple of seconds, uncredited. Yeah. But these two singers who are fairly featured at the opening sequence aren't even listed in the IMDb, which I think is interesting. Okay, another regular on the show was Missy Vaughn. She was played by Lynn Stewart, was her name. And she's good friends with Terry Bolo. I've got to meet her a few times. And she, I should say, she plays Missy Vaughn. And she comes in wearing this spectacular Christmas dress and this huge hairdo with mistletoe and ornaments, and it's all dressed up like a Christmas tree. And I mean, it's clear that gay people made the show. I mean, it's so over the top. It is so over the top. And Lynn said that her hair originally was wired for with lights, but they saw smoke coming from it, so they had to rip the thing off of her. And what ends up being in the show is ended up being the one that's not lit up. But the show, you know, it was quite much like the Pee-wee original Pee-wee Herman show, which was a Groundlings thing, which was, you know, Pee-wee was quite racy at times. Oh, just a shout out, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the original Pee-wee Herman show that's available on DVD or probably on Netflix or Amazon. The production designer was Barbara Ling, who was the production designer on Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Because that was one of the things that we talked about when I was taking them around, when they said they want to, you know, bring Hollywood back to 1969. I said, oh my God, like the Doors movie. She's like, yeah, I did that. Yeah. And then later on, we're talking about Pee-wee Herman. She goes, oh yeah, I did that show. And it was just really fun in a nice way. But so Missy Vaughn, there's a scene that like she has mistletoe in her hair and she kisses Pee-wee and he says, and then, you know, before you go making out with everyone in the playhouse, give me my gift. And she gives him the first fruitcake of the show, which right. is a running gag. And then the floor, Florrie comes up and says, Missy Vaughn, stand over me. And it's like, okay, here we go. There's one of those nods to the old kind of racy Pee Wee Herman show. But right. And then she runs off saying, there's enough of me for everyone. And so, you know, they still touched on the inside jokes. And the fruit cakes is another joke. I guess we'll hit that a little bit later on in the tour. Or in the tour. This is where my brain is. On this podcast, yeah. But so yeah, Lynn Stewart was her name. And she's a nice lady. I've met her a few times, too, at different Groundlings events that Terry has brought me to. Terry Bolo, not Terry, the little pterodactyl that's on the show, which is, I think, my favorite character. I love Terry. He's such a little queen. there's Conky, which is like a robot type of character that I think is taken straight from Max Headroom. I mean, Max Headroom, remember that animated thing? The way he spoke was, you know, poetry. It's how, you know, and Conky does that quite a bit on the show. And he spits out Pee-wee's Christmas list, and Pee-wee says he wants a yo-yo or something because you already have a yo-yo on your list. And this just brought up an interesting question. If you were an actor in a movie, would you do something that was you thought might be, I don't want to say morally, but would you do something that is, say, well, like for instance, in the show, he breaks a mirror. And I would have a real problem with that because I'm quite superstitious.
Right. Right.
And he broke a mirror three times to do this setup for when he's playing with the yo-yo and it's supposed to hit the screen. It was a sight gag. Right. It's supposed to hit the camera. And to me, it was like, it's like when people do shows where they're worshiping Satan. You know, it's like,
yeah, I always wondered that about people that are, especially if the actor is religious and you're doing something, doing and saying something that was sacrilegious, even though you don't mean it. I always wonder about that. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
That's a good question.
You know, the breaking of the mirror thing, it's like Troy will throw his baseball cap on the bed, and I'm like, no, get it. No, you can't. And bird flies into a window, forget it. I am devastated for a year.
Wait, what's the baseball hat on the bed?
It's just bad luck. It's like shoes on a table, baseball hat on the bed, or any hat on the bed. If I see a black cat, I will go around the block. Troy laughs at me, but I will back the car up. You know, I will. Yeah. So, but hey, I'm really superstitious. So I would have a problem with doing something like that. And something else I noticed is that whoever did the sound for this show should have been up for an Emmy if they didn't, because the sound effects are spectacular on this show. You know, every single thing they do, every time he opens up a bottle or something, you know, bounces on the floor or, you know, something's moving in the background, every single thing has a sound effect attached to it. It is really, really complicated and good. But I was really watching, because I watched it like four times the other night because I wanted to hit the regular movie. I watched the commentary track with the actors. I watched the commentary track with the animators. And then Troy wanted to see it, so we watched it again. But I never get tired of it. That's the twisted thing about it. But not twisted. It just shows that it stands up still. 88. That's a long time for a show. And it says it was going to be his first Christmas special. And I forget when all that... when that scandal went down where he was caught in the adult movie theater, I don't know what year that was, but maybe that's what stopped the Christmas specials from happening.
Well, 3 years later, 91.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm not sure why they didn't do it every day. It would have been, well, I don't know. Maybe this one wouldn't have been as wonderful if they did it, every year after this.
And maybe it was so much damn work that they were like, dude, we pulled it off once. Just like re-air, or just re-air that one. How about instead of having to do all that work again? Yeah.
So the and speaking of the commentary track, actually, it was John Paragon, John B., who was also the co-writer with Paul Rubens, and Miss Yvonne Lynn Stewart. And that has got to be one of the most boring commentary tracks I have ever heard. Paul Rubens is really dull, you know? Pee-wee Herman is out there.
Really?
But Paul Rubens is like, yeah, oh, this is really good. Oh, yeah. I remember this part. It was really good. Oh my God, I couldn't believe Cher came in. That was really wild. That was, yeah, it was like,
you're like, thanks honest for the insight. God,
it was like the dullest. I mean, he came up with some good nuggets, but it was just, there's no charm to this commentary track at all. They were fun. They were nice to each other, and it was an interesting nugget or two, as I said, but it was a yawner, I'll tell you. But some of the guests, like Little Richard. Little Richard shows up on ice skates in full makeup, full, you know, Little Richard makeup, right, with a pillow attached to his butt. And one of the funny, because he's on ice and he falls down, he lands on the pillow. That's what that's all about. But during the filming, when he falls down, he asked the staff or the production staff, when I fall down, do you want me to scream like a white woman or a black woman? Which is kind of funny. but he was an interesting guy. And also, there's a point where Pee Wee Herman, you know, Little Richard's falling down, and he says to Pee Wee, well, you're so good, you do it. And then Pee Wee comes up and does these amazing ice skating moves. And he's not even credited, but an Olympics figure skater came in to do that, and he's got no credit whatsoever. At the end of it, a special thanks, but his name is Charlie Tickner, and he's the one that came in. He played Hans, who came in and did this stunt ice skating for Pee Wee Herman, and anyway, so then Little Richard, you know, that was the big joke. Great gosh almighty. But he was an interesting guy. And he lived in the Hyatt Regency on Sunset for years. And he would drive down to Hollywood Boulevard and hand out Bibles.
Wait, Little Richard lived in the Riot Hyatt?
Yeah. For decades he lived there. Yeah, yeah. That is one thing I really regret, not going up there and saying something to him. That would have been cool to meet him.
I didn't know he actually lived. I mean, of course, that hotel is legendary, but that's wild.
Resident of the Riot House.
I mean, like, you know, Led Zeppelin used to take over entire floors of the hotel, but they didn't live there permanently, so that's wild. Huh.
I'd like to know if there's more people that lived in, you know, people lived at the Marmont for years and stuff like that. But you figure out these hotels, that doesn't seem like someplace that you'd want to take. I know Angeline lives in a hotel like that, a nice hotel. It's interesting. So, Liberace, Little Richard, not that far off.
Close enough.
Yeah. And he did do, he had an autobiography out a couple of years before he died. And that thing is really, I mean, he's really honest about stuff.
Right.
I mean, he's really big into voyeurism and sex with men and sex with women. And he was gay. He says, I was gay before anyone was gay. And then he turned his, you know, his heart over to God and became not gay anymore towards the end. And for some reason, he moved to Tennessee, and that's where he lived until he died in Tullahoma, Tennessee, on May 9th of 2020, this year, of bone cancer. He was 87 years old.
Wow.
They broke the mold with him.
You mentioned Paul Rubens' commentary track. Have you ever listened to any of Arnold Schwarzenegger's commentary tracks before?
No.
Everybody should look this up. I think it was for Total Recall. It's like what you described, basically. He's basically just like narrating what you're seeing on screen.
Like, and this is when I get into the car.
And then in the character, he uses the rat because they think it's him, but it's not him, it's the rat. And we were like, yeah, I know, we're watching the movie with you. Like, we can see what's happening. Like, why don't you tell us something we don't know?
Yeah, I rarely will watch a commentary track. It's you have to love a movie to do that.
And there are some really good ones out there. It just depends. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I've watched Sunset Boulevard, which is also, you know, not that interesting. It was okay. Nancy Olsen, I think, is part of it. So that was pretty good. The Sgt. Pepper movie, which we get a lot of people asking about us doing a podcast about that. The Sgt. Pepper movie with the Bee Gees and Peter Frampton. Uh-huh. I love that movie. And there's a Bee Gees documentary that just came out about a week ago.
I was going to ask you about that. And I heard it's great.
Well, I haven't seen it, but I wrote out, a lot of people said, oh, it was so good. And I wrote, well, I hope they gave some love to Sgt. Pepper. And it was like nothing was mentioned at all. And this is like, yeah, it was a pretty big deal in 78 when that movie came out.
And,
but universally panned. But when I put something out on Facebook about, I hope they gave some love to this movie, every comment is like, oh my God, I love that movie. It's one of my favorites. I watch it all the time. So there is some love for that movie. I watched Serial Mom, that commentary track, and Kathleen Turner did not get the joke. Yeah, I mean, she was, there was another one. It was like, they were making jokes and she was like, that's not funny. I don't get that. And for as good as she was as Serial Mom, I was surprised at how she wasn't, I don't think she really got it. And, but I'm trying to think of, That Thing You Do. I watched that commentary track, and that was really good. Did you see that thing that they did for COVID? When COVID first came out, they were the first group of people to do a commentary.
Yeah,
live.
I didn't watch it, no, but I heard about it, yeah.
Yeah, but they didn't have the rights to the movie. So they were all on YouTube Live, and they go, okay, push play. So you're supposed to watch it on your own, and which is a clever way to do it. But it was, you know, I don't know. I have to really love a movie to sit through a commentary track. And those are probably all of the commentary tracks I've ever watched were the ones I just mentioned. So, rest in peace, Little Richard. So, Pee Wee Herman. The other ones are kind of throwaway, not throwaways, but, you know, there was Whoopi Goldberg, who was on the phone, on the video phone. There was Oprah Winfrey, and who was in literally 10 seconds. You know, Pee Wee, let's talk. I can't because I got Whoopi on the phone and hangs up on her. And Frankie and Annette, we'll talk about that a little bit later, but Pee Wee Herman was a huge fan of the old beach movies from the 60s, you know, Beach Blanket Bingo and et cetera. And Frankie and Annette starred in a lot of those. And he was actually in Back to the Beach, which is a movie they made in the 80s, another beach movie as they were, you know, older. And Pee Wee played, he sings Surfin' Bird, which is a great song for him to sing. And, but that was a weird movie for them to go back to the beach movies in the 80s in the same locations with Frankie and Annette. It was strange, but Pee Wee was on that because he loved them so much. Otherwise he wouldn't normally do it. That came out of the commentary track. They asked him to do it, and he's like, I just want to meet Frankie and Annette. So, okay, I'll do it. Mm-hmm. And then he asked them to be on this show. And he was kind of mean to them, too, on the show. You know, he wouldn't let them go out and play in the snow until they made him, like, 500 Christmas cards handmade. and then there's Grace Jones, who came delivered accidentally to the Playhouse by the mail lady who was Reba the mail lady, who is that person, that woman, Pathica S person. I forget her name. I'm terrible at that name because it's one of those weird names that S. E. Pathica Pearson or Epathica. You know what I'm talking about? She was.
I don't.
S. Epatha Merkerson is her name. And she was, oh my gosh. So she played Reba the Mail Lady. She's won Emmys, Golden Globe, Screen Actors Guild. She was on Law and Order. She was in 395 episodes of Law and Order.
Holy cow.
She was in a ton of things. Screen credit, Jacob's Ladder, She's Gotta Have It, Terminator 2, Judgment Day, Navy SEALs. She's in a billion different things. But I know her as Reba the Mail Lady. And her name is Essie Patha Merkerson, which is not an easy name that rolls off the tongue. You know what I'm saying?
No, it is not.
But she accidentally delivers Grace Jones to the Playhouse, who comes out of the box, who was supposed to go to the White House, not the Playhouse, and comes out of the box. And I there's so many things from this movie that I use all the time. I always just say, you know, back in the box, Grace. I say it all the time. It's so stupid. But then she goes, since I'm already here, how about I sing a song? And she sings Little Drummer Boy. And it's the only time I've ever heard that song that I've liked it, because it's my least favorite Christmas song. And she sings it, and she said Bowie is the one who gave her the arrangement to sing it. She was on a plane with him and said she was doing the show. And so, how should I do this? And he suggested to do this way. So, as I said, the only time I've ever liked Little Drummer Boy is when Grace sang it, and it was pretty fun. And I got in trouble with Grace Jones. We already talked about that one, though.
We did, yes. What episode was that we talked about that?
It was the James Bond episode.
Yes.
And Cowboy Curtis, Lawrence Fishburne, who was a regular on the series. I don't think he was a regular from the Groundlings, but I did get to meet him. I think we have talked about him before, and he was doing a play downtown. He was doing a play downtown, and my friend Steve and I went down there backstage. We didn't go see the play. We just went backstage to the stage door for him to come out. And, you know, everyone's got these Matrix pictures, right, you know, for him to sign. And he's like, yeah. Well, I pulled out my Pee Wee's Christmas Special DVD, which you can't see because of this. And I had him sign. I showed him this, and his eyes just lit up. And he was like, that is cool. I love doing that show. I love being part of that show. And so that was a cool thing that he doesn't normally get quizzed about, I think.
He was happy to sign something that wasn't Morpheus.
and he was thrilled to peace. Oh, I got this too. This is Pee-wee autograph. I forget how magical this camera is that it won't works. Show things.
Yeah, so if you guys are watching the video version, Scott's holding up various memorabilia. Yeah.
Yes. Isn't that weird how it shows? It's like. Herman. Yeah. I love it. It says "Long Live Jambi." So. So Cowboy Curtis, Lawrence Fishburne. Okay. So then Joan Rivers, we talked about that. Joan Rivers is literally, so the King of Cartoons comes in and he always says, let's the cartoons begin. And Annette Funicello says, can I do it just this once? He says, of course. So she turns it on. She says, let the cartoons begin. And the Hollywood Squares pops in and is Joan Rivers. So she was actually shooting the Hollywood Squares, which I think was shot on CBS, and they recorded this cameo. And she goes, you know, hi, Annette. Hi, King. Hi, Pee-wee. Merry Christmas. And she has this amazing top on. This is Merry Christmas. But it's funny because when they pull into her and it comes on, she's like in the middle of a question or middle of an answer. So they go, you know, Annette says, let the cartoon begin, and boom, it's Joan Rivers. And she goes, sure, but I wouldn't do it with a bar of soap. And that's the way it's done. It's like, what? I love that. So anyway, she does this short cameo. And we know that Joan Rivers died in New York. She was having some throat surgery being done.
Yeah.
And they screwed up her her anesthesia and her oxygen intake, and she ended up, she stopped breathing, and they tried resuscitating her for about an hour, and it was unsuccessful, and she died of brain damage due to the lack of oxygen in 2014. And her ashes, some of her ashes were scattered in Wyoming, but she was also, friends of hers gave her ashes. She had some of Vincent Price's ashes, and her husband Edgar's ashes, and all her dog's ashes. And she was doing a show, an appearance on the Howard Stern show. And she knew what a big fan Robin Quivers was of Vincent Price. So she gave Robin some of Vincent Price's ashes, which was kind of interesting. So Joan Rivers, part of her is scattered in Wyoming. I don't know where the rest of her is, her ashes. But, Melissa certainly knows. But interesting that Joan collected her friend's ashes. There was one guy that gave her. Go ahead.
I was going to say I was a big fan of Joan Rivers. I mean, I fan of hers, and there's a really good documentary on her. I think it's the A Piece of Work documentary.
Oh yeah.
It's really good. It's really interesting. Shows how she would, you know, how she indexed her jokes, literally on index cards. Really fascinating. And then, for me, Fashion Police was a guilty pleasure on E. I always watch the Fashion Police episodes after the big award shows, you know, the week after, right? So they would always do it after the Oscars and the Golden Globes and whatever else. That was always like kind of a guilty pleasure for me. So I wish they'd find a way to, you know, they tried to keep it going with Kathy Griffith, Griffin, and it didn't really work. And I wish they could find a way to make it work again with find somebody like her. But I think she's such a one of a kind person. I don't know how do you find somebody who's funny and biting like she is and also knows fashion like she did, because she was a bit of a clothes horse, you know. She just filled a unique spot that is very hard to replace for a show like that.
She would now. It wouldn't survive. She would be killed.
Right.
You know, the stuff that she, I mean, she made jokes about September 11th. She made jokes about, you know, diseases and AIDS, etc. And it was funny. And if you don't take yourself too seriously, it's funny stuff. Lisa Lampanelli, oh my God. You know, she'd be strung up right now if you were to bring out her old comedy routines, because they were, you talk about biting. And but nowadays everything has gone so, you know, everyone's so offend happy. They want to be, you know, annoyed and offended by every single thing. And you can't say anything anymore. I mean, somebody said this to me. How can I don't know who it was. How can a generation that was brought up on South Park be this
sensitive?
Way?
Yeah.
You know? I mean, there's a lot of repression and there's a lot of things that are legit. But there's also it's like, really? Really? You know,
I have a problem when they go back to somebody's tweet from 10 years ago that nobody paid attention to them because they weren't famous yet. And, oh, you said this horrible. But, yeah, a lot of times, it's especially if it's a comedian, they were just trying to be edgy and boundary pushing to get attention for themselves, basically. And it was edgy then and now completely unacceptable now because of whatever way the winds have, you know, pushed change since then. But I have a real problem with retroactively going back and canceling somebody for something they did 10, 15 years ago. I think that's shitty. I think it's a shitty thing to do to somebody.
I mean, look at, you know, God, watching the Rat Pack stuff and the way they were with Sammy Davis. I mean, it's like, you know, Sammy Davis had to endure a lot with those guys, you know, but he did it, and nobody's stringing up Sinatra, you know. And I'm not saying he doesn't, it's terrible, you know. And nowadays, with the culture nowadays, you look at it, you go, oh, wow, that was tough. That was really, that was really rough. But it was also the 70s. And if you watch any of those old shows, especially the Dean Martin roasts, when people were drinking, and they just go for it. And it's like, damn, you know, I can't believe they said that. You know?
Right.
But they're funny. A lot of them are just funny, but it's because they're so offensive. And and that's the point. But now it's all about being offended, as you know, and it's just hard because it's just everything is just exhausting anymore. And it's just no fun. But anyway, enough of that. So, so one of their biggest coup on this show was getting Cher, and apparently that was just a fluke. You know, she responded that she'd do the thing. She gave him 20 minutes or 25 minutes. She was in the middle of doing these, promotional stuff for her perfume at that time.
Okay.
So they got her, she came in, did her thing. 25 minutes later, she was gone. No makeup. You know, nothing like that. It was just done. And it was funny. And she did the magic word, which for you guys, if you don't know, there in Pee Wee's Playhouse and in this, there was a magic word. And as soon as you learn out what the magic word is, if anyone accidentally says it, you got to scream. And Cher's the magic word that Cher got out of Conky. What's the magic word? Out came the word year. So every time anyone said Happy New Year, everyone would scream in the Playhouse. And that was the joke. So Cher, and also it was like this clever stuff. That one of the big characters was Cherry, you know, the talking chair. And they go, Cherry, Cherry, over there. There's Cherry, there's Cher. And it was really, for something they threw together, it's really clever. And the magic screen being the, you know, Magic Johnson. I mean, it's just very funny. But we touched briefly on the King of Cartoons. And his name was William Marshall. And I knew him best because he was in a movie called Blackula in the 70s. And another one, it's a blaxploitation film. And another one, it is just incredibly unpolitically correct. And one of the funniest, one of the greatest movies I've ever seen. It's just a black Dracula. There's a, you know, there's a Blackenstein that was a spoof from it, or, you know, somebody saw that Blackula was successful and they did Blackenstein. And so it was a real thing for a while there. But Blackula was a great movie, and William Marshall played Blackula, and he was like a Shakespearean actor. I mean, he had that ha-ha, you know, kind of presence to him. And they got him to do the as the king of cartoons, and he would always say, "Let the cartoons begin." And as I mentioned a little while ago, he let Annette Funicello do it for the Christmas special. But he was once a protege or an understudy for Boris Karloff, which is fascinating to me. Boris Karloff and William Marshall, he was his understudy. And at the end of his life, William Marshall, he lived on a ranch in Pacoima I don't think they were husband and wife, but they were together for over 40 years and they had four kids. And he died from diabetes and Alzheimer's in a long-term care facility in North Hollywood. He was 78 years old. And it was funny, a couple of years ago in the shop, I had a family come in and they checked him in, and they said they were, you know, his name was Marshall. And they said something about, they, you know, a cousin of theirs was in movies. I go, "It's not William Marshall, is it?" They go, "Yeah, you know who William Marshall is?" I go, "Yeah, of course I do. He was Blackula." And, anyway, I go, we got along really well. And we talked for a while. I go, "Do you want his death certificate?" And they go, "Okay." So I went to my computer, set it up, boing. I printed up William Marshall's death certificate, which they'd never seen. So it was kind of,
whoa.
It was, I don't know. That was one of those weird kind of Hollywood moments. And of course, Blackula's cousin was in, and it was neat. I love those kind of moments, and I will miss those kind of moments by living in L.A. Those kind of weird things that would never happen anywhere else.
Right.
But yeah, so rest in peace, William Marshall. Died June 11th of 2003, and he was cremated, and the locations of his cremains is unknown.
Interesting.
We talked about William Marshall, and then he gave the remote to start the cartoon to Annette Funicello, who we talked about a little while ago, How to Stuff a Wild Bikini, Muscle Beach Party, The Monkey's Uncle, which is a wild movie. But Annette recorded a song called Monkey's Uncle with the Beach Boys, and it's really one of those. It's just a clever 60s dance tune. And she was Annette, you know, in all those movies, the background dancers were like Tony Basil and Terry Garr. They all show up in all those, you know, Viva Las Vegas. Both Terry Garr and Tony Basil are in the background dancing in Viva Las Vegas. I mean, these are like legendary movies and stock dancers. But like in Viva Las Vegas, when Elvis is singing, you know, there's the girl, the little girl, the girl with the red dress on. She can do the dog all night long. That girl is Tony Basil. Who, remember, Mickey? Oh, Mickey, you're so fine, you're so fine.
Right.
That's her. And she's an epic choreographer for, you know, decades in movies. She choreographed the dance scene in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And she shows up in all those movies, too. So, but poor Annette had multiple sclerosis. And it's again one of those things that it's like, I don't know, it's just so, it's especially sad to see somebody who's so vibrant and just good,
right.
And to see, you know, then just that gradual decline, and then, you know, she was diagnosed, then she was in a wheelchair, and then she was in one of those wheelchairs that's like a tray, you know what I mean, that they just keep to have to move her because of the bed sores and things like that, you know, so she's completely incapacitated, and her house burns down in Encino. You know, so, I mean, it's like this house she's had her whole life, or her whole successful life, and right. It burns down. So she ends up going to Bakersfield with her husband, Glenn, who, you know, by all intents and purposes, they were a lovely couple and adored each other. And Annette died in Bakersfield of a heart attack and pneumonia on April 8th of 2013. And I have, actually, in my collection of things, I have Annette Funicello's gun permit, which is kind of, because Annette's the Mouseketeer, you know, the And the, you know, the beach girl and the Jiffy peanut butter, you know, spokeswoman. And but I have her gun permit in my museum. Wow. That's all stored away right now. But and one, a couple of her things, too. But and a mailbox. So God bless Annette Funicello. another guest star was Dinah Shore. Now, Dinah Shore, mm-hmm. you know, a legendary singer. She was she did, I think, the original version of Christmas song. They call it the rape song.
Baby's cold outside.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And she sang it with originally with Buddy Clark, it was. Mm. And but she also she'd been on television as Dinah Shore in the Dinah Shore Theater and the Dinah Shore Show and just the Dinah Show for like 30 years. And there was the Dinah Shore Ford Hour or something like that. She had a song called See the USA in Your Chevrolet. And mm-hmm. That was pretty iconic in the 50s. And she was brought on as this sort of long joke through the whole show. She calls him up and says, Pee-wee, I got a little song for you. And she starts singing the 12 Days of Christmas. And it goes on and on and on. And it becomes a standing joke, too. At the end of the show, she's on the 500th day. They keep cutting back, you know, to her singing. Like, they cut away, and then 20 minutes later, they're back to Dinah, and she's on the 900th day of Christmas, or 500. So, but Pee-wee ends up putting a little model of himself in front of the camera and then walking away to make it look like, are you even watching? What are you doing over there? You're ruining my gag.
Sorry, I was looking something up. By the way, what shirt are you wearing right now? What does your shirt say?
Oh, it's Men Without Hats.
Ah, nice.
Okay, I'm a huge fan. I love Men Without Hats. So, so Dinah Shore loved the joke. She, you know, she thought it was a hoot, and she ended up, you know, having a great time on the show. Now, Dinah Shore herself, she died on February 24th, 1994. She was 77 years old. Her ashes were actually cut in two, and she's part of her is at Holy Cross Cemetery in Culver City. I mean, I'm sorry, Hillside Cemetery in Culver City. Mm-hmm. And the other part is here down the street at Forest Lawn Cathedral City. And Dinah Shore, though she wasn't a lesbian, has become an iconic lesbian figure.
I was going to bring that up, especially because you moved to Palm Springs.
And they have the Dinah Shore. They call it the Dinah, and it's just this weekend, or I don't know if it's a whole week or something like that, where it's just lesbians come from all over the country. Like 20,000 lesbians converge on Palm Springs for this celebration. It's like the lesbian pride,
right?
And Dinah Shore, for some reason, maybe it was because of the golf thing, you know, Dinah Shore's golf tournament that she started.
Yeah.
But that's the one they have the Dinah.
Yeah. The full name, I think it's referred to as the Dinah Shore weekend, but I guess the Dinah is for short, is what it's called now.
Yeah. Probably 90% of the people that show up don't even know who Dinah Shore was, you know what I mean?
Right.
She's been dead for so long, but, but yeah. So,
not to be confused with Mitzi Shore of the Comedy Store.
Right. I wonder if Dinah's what her real name was. It wasn't Mitzi.
Yeah.
What was Dinah Shore's real name? Let's find out. Because look at the search that comes in, Dinah Shore lesbians. When I was doing my research, she was born. Oh, this is kind of funny. Her original name was Fanny Rose Shore.
Now, we talked about Fanny.
Yes, and Rose, because you ever watched Citizen mm-hmm. Kane, and we mm-hmm. know what Rosebud was supposed to be. That's really funny. So Fanny Rose Shore. Go figure. Someone's in the kitchen with Dinah. That's probably why. It was probably because of that, that rhyming song that was out. Someone's in the kitchen with Dinah. And because I think that she did do a cooking segment on her show. I don't know if that was the point, but maybe that's why she chose that. It's interesting.
Speaking of Mitzi Shore, the other Shore, there's a really good limited doc series on the Comedy Store that's out right now. and I don't know
if
it's on Netflix or Amazon. I think it's on one of the – or it's either on one of the streamers or it's on maybe on Showtime one of the cable channels. But it's really good. It's really interesting, the whole history of the Comedy Store and all the big comics. And they got a lot of great people, you know, the people that are still alive to be in it. And it's authentic. I thought it was a really good series on the history of that club, which kind of invented the comedy club as we know it today, you know, the modern version of it, really.
Sure, it did, yeah. So many people got their breaks there. And that was the first, man. Yeah, it was before the Improv. It was before the Laugh Factory.
And did you ever watch I'm Dying Up Here?
Interesting.
Did you ever watch I'm Dying Up Here, the scripted series? I'm Dying Up Here. It's a HBO series, I think, or a Showtime series. It was a scripted series. They did two seasons of it a few years ago. It's called I'm Dying Up Here. I think Jim Carrey may have even been a producer on it. But it was loosely based on that. You know, fictional characters mostly. The comedy drama series for Showtime premiered in 2017. I thought it was really good. Executive produced by Jim Carrey. I thought it was great. It only went for two series, but it was still interesting, and it kind of covers a lot of the same territory that the Comedy Store documentary covers, in my opinion. But there's obviously a character based heavily on Mitzi Shore, and the way she ran the club is very similar to how Mitzi did, and yeah. So they covered the whole when all the comedians went on strike against her because they weren't getting paid. And then the whole, you know, how they all wanted to get on Carson, you know, that was your big break. And I thought it was really interesting. And one of the guys gets on it. One of the guys, I think, was kind of based on Freddie Prinze. You know, he gets on a sitcom and then kind of starts to hate being on the sitcom, and you know, he becomes the catchphrase guy, and I don't know. I thought it was a really interesting series. I was
Freddie Prinze when he died at 22. You know, it's just like,
crazy.
It's like you're in a show. I mean, 22 years old is how old he was when he killed himself, I think. It's like, what? Yeah. You haven't. How can you live that down? How can you? It's not. It's mental illness, and I make.
Yeah.
I can't.
It was. He was mentally
ill.
Mental illness combined with drugs. With drug use. Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy what he did. He blew up when he was like 19, you know.
Yeah,
and it was over 3 years later. Yeah.
Boy, so I looked it up, and Dinah Shore was on a radio show as her real name, and then she sang the song Dinah, as I was just mentioning, and the disc jockey couldn't remember her name, just called her the Dinah Girl, and that's when she became Dinah Shore. So. Dinah died. Now, so I started talking about the lesbians because Katie Lang she sings in the show. And this is the old Katie Lang. The original Katie Lang, when she started in show business, was doing country music, like bluegrass almost music. Huh. And she was being wacky. You know, she wore the weird clothes. Her cowboy boots, her trademark was she wore cowboy boots that were cut off at the ankle. And she would safety pin little barn animals to her clothes and stuff. And she was great. I mean, she has a very distinctive voice. And
right.
She did probably three or four country records. They were great records. They were my favorites. And then, but she was never accepted because she was a lesbian, was never accepted by the country music audience.
Yeah.
And and her last album that she did that was country was called Shadowland. And it's the saddest thing that this wasn't embraced because it was produced by Owen Hart. And Owen Hart produced Patsy Cline and Loretta Lynn and these legend, and this is old country, you know, that she's singing these songs, and she kicks these songs' asses. And the end of it, she sings Honky Tonk Angels, and they bring in Loretta Lynn and Kitty Wells and Brenda Lee, and the four of them sing this song, and it's just like, these are country legends. Here's Katie, and they still wouldn't embrace her. And I think Katie just went, you know what, screw you. And she went into, she does her pop music basically for lesbians. I mean, that's all. I went to see her a couple of years ago. It's almost all lesbians in the audience, which is fine. I don't care about that. It doesn't matter. She's a great singer, but it just she just sort of gave up on trying to make it as a country singer. And it's the saddest thing because she's got the talent and she's got the personality, but she was just never embraced, and I think they really screwed up because she's a great singer. She really, her, she did crying with Roy Orbison. It's like, oh my God, you can't sit through that song and not get choked up. And you know, it's just a real shame. A real waste, not a waste, but it's just a, I think a missed opportunity for her to continue doing country music. I thought she was great. And I guess hers was the longest segment it took to film for this for the special. They said it took 6 hours. it was a fluke. But she sang Jingle Bell Rock. It was great. Another quick cameo was the Countess, who was the cow who was royalty, who and she said everything was moveless and we must get moving. and they had her introduce her friend Princess Zsa Zsa, and it was Zsa Zsa Gabor, and as another 15-second cameo. You know, she comes in. It's funny. She won't even look at the puppet, the cow, just shoves her aside and walks in and says, you know, I love you, Pee-wee, and I love you, Princess Zsa Zsa. And that was basically at Merry Christmas, and she left. But
yeah, some of the appearances were basically just like, hi, wave, and then off.
Yeah.
How's your tab today?
Oh, almost empty. You know, I had to buy more on eBay. It sucks. But it's gone. And, you know, what sucks is that it only has a shelf life of like 8 months. So once, you know, you can stock up, but you got less than a year to drink it. Yeah. And so I'm very precious with my tab. I don't drink all that much.
You not following the tab saga, they have discontinued it. So now people are, like Scott, are paying premiums for what's left, the stock that is left out there, and then eventually it will disappear.
I believe it was the first diet drink, and it still has saccharin in it. Hmm. Yep, caffeine, aspartame, all the good stuff.
So, all the good chemicals.
Right. So Zsa Zsa Gabor died on December 18, 2016. She was 99 years old, and I went to Zsa Zsa's estate sale. We ended up cleaning up, actually. Got a lot of stuff. And the house was used in Behind the Candelabra, the Liberace movie, which is just like ticks another box. Right. And and I bought the concrete urns. And these things are probably about 5 feet tall, maybe 4 feet tall each. These solid concrete urns that were on both sides of her swimming pool that show up in the movie. So I got those, and those were in the front of the shop for, as long as we had the museum, and they're in storage now. And then, what else did I get? Well, Troy bought bought this weird tape recorder, and I was looking at it the other day, and he goes, oh, yeah, I got that from the Prince. I go, what are you talking about? He goes, yeah, it was at the estate sale. It was like $10, and the Prince came over and goes, that's mine. It's not Zsa Zsa's. No, it's mine. That was mine. It's this weird little it's this weird little record player. So Troy bought it, and it doesn't work, but it's just he likes to collect odd, you know, vintage appliances.
Yeah.
And then I was looking at this shelf. There's a bar, and behind it is a shelf. There's probably five shelves crammed with glassware, you know, just tons of glass stuff. And I go, how much is that thing in the middle up in the top? The Prince says, you want that? $300, everything back there is yours. I'm like, okay. So I, you know, they gave me boxes, and me and the housekeeper Troy are packing up five boxes of glassware from Zsa Zsa's house, and all this stuff showed up in Behind the Candelabra. You know, so I'm looking at it, but some of it was like Costco wine glasses and stuff like that, the Kirkland brand on it. So, you know, but still, I mean, they came out of Zsa Zsa's house, and they showed. I even have my little Zsa Zsa. I brought them to show the little cocktail weenie sticks. I have
those are
a bunch
cool.
of these. Yeah, so these are from
Zsa Zsa's.
What are
they? Like, what's
house.
On them?
There's little
what
forks.
Yeah, but they're, what
and,
is
oh, they're
just...
they're like stones. They're
interesting.
They're different sort of. Here's a yellow one that'll show up a little bit better. But they they're little rocks and little polished stones. So
those are cool.
So I got. Yeah, they are cool. I've got a ton of stuff at Zsa Zsa's. I wanted her glasses because there's a pair of prescription glasses, and the housekeeper told me that Zsa Zsa would do her crossword puzzles with these. I like stuff like that, you know?
Yeah.
So, but it ended up being, some designer. I don't know who it was. And they were like $20. I go, okay, I'll buy those. They go, no, that's Mark, whatever his name was, this designer. I go, yeah, so? And he goes, yeah, yeah, but those are expensive frames. I says, yeah, but they're prescription. What are you going to do with them? And he's like, I can get new lenses made. I'm like, whatever, man. He goes, I'll give it to you for $100. It's like, you know, forget it. Just forget it.
Right.
So, you know, estate sale people are dicks, you know, when they're like that. I hate when they're like, that's going to cost you. So anyway, poor Zsa Zsa. So Zsa Zsa's funeral was at Good Shepherd Catholic Church on Sunset. And on Santa Monica Boulevard, is it Sunset? No, Santa Monica Boulevard in Beverly Hills. And this is where Ava Gabor's funeral was, too. I went to her funeral back in 95, I think it was. But the prince brought Zsa Zsa's cremains in a Gucci dog carrier to the funeral. So Zsa Zsa was taken to her own funeral in a dog carrier by her husband. Which was actually on sale in the estate sale. And I really wanted that, but they wouldn't break up the... it was Louis Vuitton. They wouldn't break up the set. But I really wanted the dog carrier. So I found a picture of me holding the dog carrier. But yeah. And then Zsa Zsa is buried underneath Ava's tombstone at Westwood Cemetery. The prince went there. They lifted up the tombstone. I guess they poured Zsa Zsa there or buried her there. And covered her back up so she doesn't even have a tombstone. But I was there the day of the funeral, and I could tell it was done. And there's a picture of the prince and at the tomb that day. So yeah. So poor Zsa Zsa. But she was a trip. She was a trip. And and also the other thing I got there was this really weird photo album. And in it were personal photos. Like the prince was literally tearing Zsa Zsa's albums in half and selling them. You know, and Elisa Jordan, actually from LA Woman Tour, she bought one of the halves and gave it to me. And I'm going through these pictures, and I'm like, there's these tons of pictures of Zsa Zsa and all these other people and this guy, and it's in like some New York apartment. And I'm looking, and it's like, yeah, there's a cake there. I wonder if it's one of her husband's. So I looked it up, and it was one of her husband's. It was her wedding with the husband. So I'm looking at the other people, and there's this girl there with this like bouffant hairdo. And she's younger. So I'm like, I wonder if that's the kid of the husband. So I looked her up on Facebook and I found out we have one mutual friend. So I said to my friend, why don't you reach out to this woman and say, is this the one whose father was married to Zsa Zsa? So she reaches out to me and says, yeah, that was me. I said, I have your father and Zsa Zsa's wedding pictures, and you're all over these pictures. And she's like, oh, that's the weirdest thing. She goes, I'm going to be in L.A. next week. Do you want to get together? So she came to the shop, and I showed her all these pictures, and she was telling me who they were in the pictures and talked. Yeah, it was just a weird Facebook, internet, oh, my God thing. And that's all awesome. Down to the prince selling Zsa Zsa's personal photographs, which I find really offensive, actually. I mean, I'm glad I have them, but right. Troy loves going through people's pictures in estate sales, and I find it like so gross because it's like, you know, I would die if like my parents' pictures ended up in some estate sale and people were like flipping through them and go, oh, for a dollar, you can have three of them. So I have all my personal photographs have been scanned in, and every physical photograph is in a box that's sealed up, and there's instructions to burn it when I die because I don't want a single one of these photos ending up in somebody pawing through it in some estate sale. I find that so gross.
I just think it's weird that like that there is no family that wants the personal stuff like that, like the personal photo albums.
Yes.
Those are like the greatest heirlooms, in my opinion, are the old photo albums of the families, you know? Most of the people are gone now, you know? And that's why I saw I tried to do this online auction a few years ago. They did that was of Irving Thalberg and Norma Shearer's estate, and like they had like a wedding, their wedding photo in a frame that was the actual one that hung in their home, you know, in Santa Monica that they had on the beach there. And I remember thinking, like, aren't any of his relatives still alive that would still want that? Like, that's always so strange to me. And I also follow a lot of World War II memorabilia stuff. And I'll see stuff like that come up. You know, some airman's personal effects and his bomber jacket and, you know, his flight records and stuff. And I'm like, what? His kids don't want that? Like, it's really strange to me when I see stuff like that get put out for sale. But sometimes people don't have heirs or they aren't close to them or whatever. So it's better than throwing them away, I guess.
I guess in a situation like that where you're talking about literal history, You know, maybe there is an appreciation for that with somebody else who might, you know, I mean, it's like that, you know, Troy and I don't have any kids. We don't want to have kids, but we got a lot of stuff. We're really sentimental people. And now that we're moving, I can see all the crap I have that my grandparents made or my dad made. And we're here. And once we die, it's like that's going to end up in some estate sale. It's a real shame. I mean, I have a niece and a couple of nephews, but I don't think they have a, you know, not as sentimental as we are. And, and at the end of the day, they're just kind of, you know, stings. But but yeah, sentimentally, it was important to us to save them. But what, you know, what do you do with them then when you die? Which is why the estate sales and the thrift stores are so huge here.
Right. Exactly.
But personal photographs, I find that so gross. I just gotta they got to be burned. Burned. I do not want people pawing through them. There's an element of, you know, when you're famous, when you if you pursue fame, that's fair game in a way, but it's still really, really personal. It's like, I don't know. Anyway, so, okay, Mrs. Renee, who was on the show, Suzanne Kent, she brought the Jewish thing, and I never knew the dreidel song, which I thought was interesting, you know, to learn about Hanukkah and the seven, you know, the eight nights of Hanukkah. You know, as a person who was never brought up around Jewish people, it was interesting to see that, and interesting to find out that the dinosaur family who lived behind the walls were actually Jews, which I love, and they had a little menorah and stuff like that.
It's funny you hadn't heard that song, because this around the time that this happened, I was in elementary school when this came out. I was the perfect age to be a Pee Wee Herman fan, but I wasn't. I never really watched the show, but I had friends that were into him. But we always did, you know, the Christmas concert every year, right, for elementary school, and there was we always sang the dreidel song. It was like the one little hat tip that they always that the program did to any of the Jewish kids that were in school. Of course, it was the rest of it was all songs about Santa Claus, but then we always did the dreidel, you know, made of clay song. So that's interesting. You weren't as familiar with that one.
No, but it's funny you bring that up, too, because when I was in elementary school, our music teacher really, you know, he taught us Hava Nagila. And none of us knew what it was. I've been to Jewish weddings now where they sing Hava Nagila, and I know the words to it, which is weird, but I didn't know what it was. We didn't know. We weren't told what it was. We were just singing this song in this different language. And I remember we sang Spanish Eyes, you know, Blue Spanish Eyes. And then I remember, because, you know, this little kid, these kids in Detroit are singing, it was C-C-C, you know, as in yes, yes, C-C-C, and we sang it C-C-C, because we didn't know how to speak in Spanish. C-C-C-C.
You saw the S-I and thought it was pronounced Sai. That's really funny.
It's Sai. We were taught that by the music teacher. But we were well-rounded in that regard. You know, we learned how to sing different songs that weren't just, you know, little American songs. I forgot about that until just now. It's interesting. God. That was fun. Anyway, Detroit Public Schools, shout out. let's see, we've got Ricardo, who was the resident hunk. Pee Wee always had a resident hunk in, you know, a sports guy in a soccer costume. There was always one in all the shows, and Ricardo was the one in this one, played by an actor named Vic Trevino. And he showed Pee Wee how to do the pinata, which he'd never heard about before, and he's teaching him how to do this on the show. And then they bring in Charo. And Charo, who is the, you know, Spanish-American, well, she's Spanish, born in Spain, singer, who is top 10 classical guitarist in the world, sings Feliz Navidad, and also holds the record for Love Boat appearances, Charo does.
Oh, and, interesting.
And so she sings Feliz Navidad. Ricardo, the hunk, is the one who taught Pee Wee how to do it. And just as a side note, Charo lives on the corner. This is dark. Charo lives in the corner of Benedict Canyon, and I forget what the name of the Lomitas, but there's that side street, because technically she lived like a door down from Lucy. And but Charo, her husband, just to go back to the curse of Benedict Canyon, last year committed suicide in the alley behind the house with a gun. So there was another sort of check mark to the curse of Benedict Canyon, I think.
Wow.
But he'd been ill for a long time, And it just, I don't think anyone was prepared for that, but it is what happened. And Charo is such a sweet lady. She's like the Spanish Dolly Parton, you know, mm-hmm. and just a kind lady. And she became a big, I don't know if it's TikTok or what, Instagram, when the COVID first started kicking in. She had a video that went viral that was washing your hands. And she's famous for being beautiful, having a large chest, and making jokes and being the butt of jokes or whatever. And she would say things and mispronounce them, and it was funny. And so she was saying, you're supposed to count to 20 when you're washing your hands. Right. So you in America would say, you would count to Mississippi, but she couldn't say Mississippi. So she'd say Mishi-pee-pee. So she's saying one Mishi-pee-pee, two Mishi-pee-pee. Oh, God bless Charo. She is a national treasure, and she still looks amazing. She looks fantastic, and she doesn't look like she's aged a day since this show was made. So, which brings us after that to the Del Rubio triplets.
Yes.
Three gals, three guitars, one birthday.
And who were they, for people who don't know?
Well, they were identical triplets, Edie, Millie, and Elena, and they sang and played guitar, and they were not particularly good at singing,
right?
But they were again three of the most charming people, identical triplets, which alone is like my eyes pop out of my head because I think it's fantastic because it's an unusual people thing, and I love unusual people. And they dressed alike. They always stood in the same order, the order that they were born. They would always be, I had to write it down, Edie on the left, Millie in the middle, and Elena on the right. Anytime they entered a room or left a room, whenever they signed autographs, whenever they, it was always in that order, order that they were born. And they became sort of cult TV. I think Pee Wee's the one who brought it to my attention. They were around LA and they would play cabaret stuff. They would sing like Whip It, and they'd sing Light My Fire on the guitar. And they sang in the show in the Winter Wonderland. They sang Winter Wonderland in Pee Wee's Christmas special. But they were just bizarre. Big blonde hair. You know, they were clearly, in their 70s when they were doing this, wearing mini skirts and go-go boots and singing Winter Wonderland. And it was a sight to be held. They ended up on Letterman. They ended up on Married with Children. They ended up on Night Court. They were, I think they may have been on the Golden Girls. I mean, they became real celebrities in their own. And there was a show, I just found this the other day. There was a show in the 80s called The New Monkees. And it was, they were fabricating this new group of monkeys. The Del Rubio triplets were on an episode, and they sing this song, and it's like right psychedelic stuff. I mean, the Del Rubios don't sing at all in this. But they made them look so cool and so hip. The Del Rubios were kind of silly. They were kitschy. They were campy. They weren't terrifically good, but back when they were first discovered, they used to travel around in a station wagon to nursing homes and sing for nothing. They just wanted gas money. There were three of the nicest ladies. And then they started finding this cult following. And then Pee Wee put them on this, and that's what brought it to my attention. But then they were doing the bars. They did a bar tour in Chicago. I saw them do a show at a bar called Berlin. I just could not be nicer and sweet, sweet ladies. And here's my autographed Del Rubio triplets to Scott from them. I don't know if I put this in there, but I'll put this on for a second. There's my picture with the Del Rubios. I love them. But yeah, they were just the nicest people. And God bless them. So let me go back to my regular office. Okay. So Edie, Millie, Elena, they were born August 23rd, 1921 in the Panama Canal Zone. And their actual birth name was Boyd, but they chose the name Del Rubio because Rubio means blonde in Spanish. And Edie died of cancer in 1996, Elena in 2001 of cancer, and Millie died of pneumonia in 2011. And they're buried all at Holy Cross Cemetery. They're very, very, they took their religion, their Catholicism, very seriously. I think they were virgins, too. I do believe that they probably, because they did everything together. You know, when are they going to have a chance? They lived in a mobile home in Palos Verdes, in a mobile home park on the ocean. And they'd always drive in the same car. They were something, and they lived it. They really, really lived it. So God bless them. So the Del Rubio triplets are all dead. God, Millie was the last one. And I was at a party. And I spoke to Millie a couple times. I had her phone number. Oh, let's just skip this. It doesn't matter. No, it's
going to make
this look like a day. No, I knew that Millie was long-winded. And I always thought, well, why didn't you get back together again? Just do yourself, you know? And I didn't realize that this, in retrospect, I realized how callous that was, you know, because they were a trio and she would never dream of going out on her own. And so I said, well, you know, why don't you do appearances as yourself? And you know, it was not nice. And I wish I had more tact than that back then. It's sad, but there, as you could tell, she was defeated after her sisters went. So it was really sad, and that she lived for as long as she did after the other two were gone. That had to have been really difficult for her. So yeah. One of the things, okay, so through this whole movie, one of the big gags throughout the movie is the fruitcakes. Everyone gives him a fruitcake, and he's like, everyone right. supposedly hates fruitcake. And, you know, so there is sometimes there is a... I want to say this movie would appeal to gay people for a lot of different reasons. And something that is funny is that Pee-wee gets so many fruitcakes that he decides that he's going to make a room out of fruitcakes. And I'm right. building a new wing to the playhouse made entirely out of fruitcakes. And,
right.
And they open up the doors, and there's these two shirtless guys dressed like construction workers, you know, putting fruitcakes together and making walls out of these things. It's like, or, you know, and on the commentary track, they even, you know, they were kind of laughing to each other without saying it because they didn't want to spell it out. But
right.
it was clearly
right.
a nod to, you know, to something. It's quite funny to have fruitcakes and have, like, the village
yeah.
people there. So it was kind of funny. But the last thing, it was Aaron Fletcher, is who in all the commentary tracks agreed that he was Santa. I mean, he was Santa on the show, but he was like the most legitimate Santa ever. You know, he looked it,
right.
he lived it, he sounded it. And not like the other guy. Remember, I think we talked about Leroy Shulls before. He was the guy that changed his name to Santa and lived in the North Pole in New York. And
right.
Ended
Our
up
first
dying
show
like,
ever, I think we talked about
yeah.
that. Yeah.
He died like the day before Christmas. It was so sad in a hotel room in Chicago.
Right.
But of a heart yeah. attack. I mean, there was nothing wrong with him. But anyway, this guy, Aaron Fletcher, played. He was on St. Elsewhere. He was on a sitcom starring Sally Struthers. And he played Santa on this show in 1988. In March of 1990, he passed away. I couldn't find a cause of death, but he was only 63 years old. He died in Los Angeles in 1990. So God bless you, Santa. And the other thing I was going to talk about was you wanted to talk about somebody that was involved with the movie. In what way?
Yeah, so Wayne White is an artist who was involved with the whole Pee Wee Herman series. And he, I think he did some animation work for them for the show, and he did set design and just wherever they needed, right? And he kind of got his own prominence as a visual artist years later. He started doing these paintings where he would basically, you take a painting that you find at like a thrift store, or like a flea market, right? One of these like cheapo landscape paintings, like something you'd see in like a doctor's office, right? Something really kind of drab and boring, like a mountain meadow or a seascape. And he started painting onto them. So he would paint, like, his big thing was he would paint words into the picture, and he would do them in 3D, kind of in the scene. So it looked like there were giant letters, you know, hovering over the lake, right? And they would say weird shit, like, probably the one that's most famous is just like a forest scene, and he put the words fan-fucking-tastic in letters across it, you know? So there's, like, a lot of humor in them. In these paintings, and they got big. And what's wild is that I when I was early years in LA, probably about 15, 16, 17 years ago, there was a diner on Vermont Street there in kind of Hollywood, Los Feliz area, that had his paintings for sale on the walls. And I remember seeing these and being struck by how... Oh, that had to have been
Fred 62 or something,
that
right?
That was it. It was Fred 62. Yeah. I'm almost positive they had some of his paintings. Yeah. And I came really close to buying one. And they were maybe $1,000, $1,200, and it was just a little too much for me at that, especially at that time, for me to be able to do.
Yeah.
And it's a bummer because now they go for like 10 to 20 grand. Like, they're sought after, pretty sought after paintings.
Oh, right. I just found the fan-fucking-tastic one. That is really cool.
It's so cool, right? So they did a documentary on him a few years ago called Beauty is Embarrassing, the Wayne White Story, that is really interesting. And there's a bunch of stuff in it about his work on Pee-wee Herman as well. So Pee-wee Herman fans, definitely check the documentary out. And it's just really interesting just to see this the creative outpouring from this one person, you know, how the kind of creativity that was behind, you know, that show, the creative minds that were behind it is really fascinating. So I'm a creative person, but I'm always in awe of people that are like super creative, you know, like, you know, just how you only see 1% of their ideas that they have, you know, they're just bursting with ideas. So yeah, it's interesting. So Beauty is Embarrassing, the Wayne White Story. Yeah, it's a really good doc.
Another woman that worked on the show was the makeup person, V. Neal, who did Jambi's makeup, the genie whose head is in the box. But she won an Emmy for the Pee-wee Herman show for her makeup. She did the makeup for Mrs. Doubtfire. She did the makeup for Beetlejuice. And she also did, there was a show that was really big, I don't know if they still make it, called Face Off. It's one of those competition shows where people were doing like horror and science fiction makeup. And she was a regular on that. But she won an Emmy for the Pee-wee show, which is pretty cool. And lastly, I guess the only other thing that I found of relevance, I mean, to me, there's a lot of stuff that we didn't even talk about, but 48 minutes of TV, and here we are, spending hours on it. But one of the puppeteers was Van Snowden, and Van Snowden was most famous for being on, where is my picture? He was the puppet for H.R. Puffin Stuff.
And oh, right on, hold it up a little higher.
Yeah, I got to meet him, and I talked to him about the production of the show, which was pretty neat, because I wanted to know more about Jack Wilde, who was the star of H.R. Puffin Stuff, and he was a really, really nice guy, who's dead now, actually. I didn't get the details of his death, but Van Snowden, rest in peace, he did some amazing puppeting. And that's what I have on Pee-wee's Christmas special.
I think we did it. And again, you can watch it, I believe, on Netflix now, so you can see what it is we're talking about. It is a wild and kooky special. Like 48 minutes or whatever it is long. All right. Well, thank you to everybody. Thank you again to our Patreon supporters. It's patreon.com/dearlydepartedpod if you want to become a supporter, if you aren't one already. You can join for as little as $2 a month.
And everyone have a very happy Hanukkah. Well, I think Hanukkah's over with now. And I have a Merry Christmas and Happy New Year!
Goodbye, 2020. Oh, you know what, though? Doing this show made 2020 a little more tolerable, I think. And I think it did for people that listen as well. So it did for us as well.
I hope so.
Having something to focus on. It did for me, anyways. I it's something fun to distract, I guess.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope it makes it gives a couple of people a laugh.
So here's hoping that 2021 brings back some sense of normalcy to the world, whatever that even means anymore. But hopefully things look up in the new year. So
agree.
All right, guys, we will see you and we will see you in the new year.
Take care. Thanks again. January. I'm going to go make a cocktail with Zsa Zsa's weenie fork.
As you do.
This has been an episode of the Dearly Departed Podcast. Dig up more episodes at dearlydepartedpod.com and on iTunes and Google Play. See you next time.